that would create a launch abort system. All the electronics is basically controlled from the command module, but automatic stuff, like the wires running down, was connected to this guidance ring or collar that went around the whole diameter of that ring. If you see an exploded view of the Saturn V, you can see all the different stages, and you got the service module and the Apollo spacecraft itself. Right below the service module, where it attaches to that final stage, you'll see one very fine ring going around that whole diameter. That's what.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Bill, how many of those motors existed at the bottom of the Saturn V? I think it was generating something like 6.5 million pounds of thrust, but how many of those motors were there, and how many of them were gimbaled by that fancy launch computing system, WS2N, K2RIW?
Okay, and this is Paul, by the way. And it was the Saturn V. It was big. Five of these Saturn F1, call them the F1 engines, and they all had to be gimbaled. I think I remember 6 degrees or something. That's all you got out of it. Not much. But they had to work like that. So the total thrust was 7.5 million pounds of thrust. And that really hasn't been beaten until we get to, the SLS that's coming up, the Space Launch System. Probably 2021 will probably be the first test launch, maybe 2020, the end of 2020 is the earliest. That will be up to 9 million, and they'll work their way up to 10.5 million as time goes on. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, it's starting to make sense now. I think each of those five engines was 1.5 million pounds, and there's five of them. And I think you're saying they all gimbaled. Wow. So they all have to pivot. That's a lot of pivoting thrust in order to make sure that thing goes straight, with hopefully a real good inertial guidance system on board. With people make jokes about the inertial guidance system. They call it the DAS, Stargaze and Steering Works. Pigeon German. People used to make jokes about that. So, looks like we've got a partial answer to your question, Bill. And sorry, Paul, but I keep calling you some other name. AC2IS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Thanks, Dick. I'm looking at the moment at a picture of a circuit board that apparently was from the LVDC. It's an extremely modern-looking thing. It's a 12 or 15-layer circuit board with a lot. It's basically just layered up with what looks like ICs, small-ish ICs. Very high density of interconnections all these ICs are through-hole components, and a lot of legs just sort of stuck into the board. Looks very different from earlier circuit boards, which are basically two-layer boards. I was wondering if there was a person that would know about, I believe the LVDC was designed and built by IBM. But if there was anybody that actually knew about the internal workings of that computer, AC2IS.
And can you imagine the vulnerability of that computer to a lightning strike? And I think Apollo 12 was struck with lightning on takeoff, and I believe the astronauts on board had to reset circuit breakers in the middle of that launch, which had been tripped by that lightning strike. Am I getting the story approximately right, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet?
Yeah, lightning strikes on the way up on Apollo 12, so you got the right one. And that was Conrad, Dean, and Gordon. And word came back from Mission Control, to throw one of the switches. And nobody on board, Conrad or, you know, Gordon or Dean, knew what it was right away, but in a few short seconds, Dean remembered going through an exact simulation, because everything lit up. I mean, everything said, when I got hit with lightning, that, you know, we're in bad shape. All kinds of warning lights went on. But he went through that scenario in one of his tests that they were doing on, a simulator when they were in air. And he remembered where this one switch was. He hit that, and then everything went back to normal. So they were able to continue, you know, and get into Earth orbit and eventually into TLI after Mission Control gave them the okay after they checked it out. When they were in orbit, they went to TLI, translunar injection. So that was approved, and off they went back to Earth.
But because of those two lightning strikes on that launch came very close to becoming aborted. And the abortion procedure might have been the command module gets separated from the rest of the launch vehicle because of a failure of thrust, because engines turned off, because the computer said, hey, something's wrong. On various launches, I think at least one of the multiple engines would go into a failure mode and stop thrusting. In some cases, I believe they would press on to they called it abort to orbit. As long as you have enough thrust left and enough fuel left, you can do without an engine and just burn the remaining engines for a longer period of time, I believe is what goes on here. But because of that lightning strike, there could have been a latent failure, which made it difficult to fire an engine when you're on the backside of the moon trying to do a lunar orbit insertion burn. Or the more important burn is the burn that gets you back out of orbit in order to make you come back home. If that burn doesn't work, you're in a heap of trouble. So as I see it, because of that lightning strike, I'll bet you there was some nervous fingernail chewing during some portions of that mission. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, one of the engines actually shut off early, one of the five engines. But they had plenty of thrust to make it to orbit. But Alan Bean didn't find that right switch, and they couldn't get these lights to come off, they would have been directed to hit the abort button, which unfortunately would have ended that mission. The last system would come on, the launch abort system, it was a tractor set up there, off the front of the capsule. You have this cover covering the capsule, and on that you have this, it looks like a radio tower, a rolling tower attached to it, and they had these solid booster rockets, which would instantaneously, within a millisecond or so, would light and pull the whole capsule off, leaving behind the service module, and then from there the jettison rockets would have went, separating the launch abort cover and tower away from the capsule, and then Apollo would have been they would have had the chutes would have been able to be open at that point to get them down safely to the ocean. That would have been the result of that mission, and that would have delayed a lot of future Apollo missions after that. Ironically, the next one was Apollo 13. We know what happened to that. Back to you, Dick.
That launch escape tower system that sat on top of the command module was there on every one of the Apollo launches, and except for ground testing procedures, during actual launches of Apollo 11 through 17, that system never got used. Is that true? I'm almost positive that system never got used. So, and just the, I bet you they were glad they never had to use it, because to make sure that that worked and then launched you to a high enough altitude to deploy the parachute, and then you come back down, hopefully you're enough in the mission where you're coming down into the Atlantic Ocean. If that abort had to take place very early in the mission, where you're coming back down on Florida, I'm reasonably sure that the command module not hitting water would be a much harder impact, is my guess. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, that was designed to hit water. It probably might have survived land, but it was really designed to land in the ocean. And the only launch abort system that the United States used was during the test of one of the earlier flights. They just sent up the top stage, the S-1B. They would launch that with a dummy capsule on top, and then they used the launch and escape system to test that and make sure it worked. So they launched that once out of Florida. You can find that on one of the old YouTubes. But, you won't see that system again until you get to the SLS system, Space Launch System, coming up probably 2020. You'll see that, and then you'll see that on the actual crew missions following that one. The only time it was used in real life to save somebody was timed it out. The only time it was used was to save a crew was Soyuz 10 mission, they call it. Soyuz 10. And the rocket just started to come apart at on the launch pad. And the launch controllers had the controllers the ability to abort the mission. The crew didn't, which was terrible. I mean, we didn't. We had both ways. But in Russia, they didn't. But somebody at the Russian mission control did hit the button and save the crew, and it got pulled away from the exploding rocket. Back to you there.
Was that our Soviet cosmonauts on board? Were there any American astronauts on that launch from Russia where it had to be aborted with that abort system? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, that was in the early days. So that was just Russians. I believe they were going to go to Salyut 7 was after that. That was 7 was more successful, but they were space stations, the early space stations before Mir that Russia put up.
And Mir at the time was, I guess, the biggest thing ever put in space. But the International Space Station right now is what? At least 4 or 5 times bigger than Mir ever was, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, the Salyut 10 mission was going up to, Soyuz 10 mission that was aborted was supposed to be going to one of the earliest space stations. They called them Salyut numbers, Salyut 6, Salyut 7, and they would last, you'd send a crew up for a month and bring them down, or a couple of weeks in the beginning, and then bring them down. They didn't have a dual docking system, well, the early one anyway, didn't have it, where you could send up a progress ship and dock with it, resupply them to keep them going. But Mir, of course, had that, and that followed all the Salyut missions, and that was, they kept that for like 15 years. And the size is, yeah, you're right, about one-fifth the size of the International Space Station.
Okay, so when it comes to what really is going on with that computer that's on board the bottom of the Apollo spacecraft, maybe we'll have a little more information on that next week, Bill. The next person on our list with a question was Matt, November 2, Romeo Victor Papa. Go right ahead, Matt, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Thank you.
K2LYY, Joe, are you back at the microphone? K2LIW? Okay, we don't have Joe. One more call from Matt. N2 Romeo Victor Papa. Are you there, Matt? K2LIW? Okay. There was a guy named Ray that tried to sign in. There was a guy named Bernie that tried to sign in. Is there anyone else that has a question for the TechNet? Question or comment? Give me a call, that is a name right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
I believe Dr. Roy last week said that he's going to be asking for Houston for today.
And WS2M with a broadcast, TV broadcast question for probably forever.
Yeah, right?
A question for Paul.
Okay, who said they had a question for Paul? Go right ahead.
AC2LR, this is K.
Go right ahead, K.
Paul, have there been any updates on the Voyager missions? And I was also wondering if any other countries had similar missions that went out of, or headed out of the solar system.
I don't think anybody's come close to that. The 132 astronomical units, 12 billion miles of Voyager. That's a record that's going to stand for a long time, is my guess, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, okay. What are we up to? 40 years now with those two missions. And they're still doing good. 60 Minutes, I believe it was last week, had a very good piece on that. A 20-minute long story about the Voyagers. And Anderson Cooper did it. So he got to talk to Ed Stone, one of the original people that handled the two missions. He was in charge of that. And he's still involved today. He's 81 years old. I think he started off in his 30s. And then they spoke to Ann Duran, the one with the record. You know, she was married to Carl Sagan. She helped develop those two gold records that are on Voyager 1 and 2. And that's the latest update. They'll probably be functioning, they think, for at least another 10 years from now. This was just last week I saw it. So 10 years from now. Any other missions? Let me drop it before I repeat it. And lose my voice. Dick, by the way, I don't know how you do this all night long without losing your voice. I go 15 minutes and I start to lose my voice. The Voyager's 40-year mission now is the only one that have left the solar system. And the next one to leave... Functioning ones. The next one to leave that will be functioning will be New Horizon, the one that went to Pluto in 2015. And that's going to go to the Kuiper Belt object in 2019, January 1st. So they'll be functioning. There's two other ones, Pioneer, that are leaving the solar system. And they were launched before Voyager 1 and 2, so Pioneer 10 and 11, let me drop it. They also had RTGs on them, radioisotope thermal electric generators, but they think eventually the thermocouples kind of like failed on that, and that's what I remember reading about that. So they lost contact all many years ago with those two. And as far as the Russians or any other country, nobody's been able to send anything that far. Nothing's on a hyperbolic path by any of the countries, Japan or they've launched things at the heliocentric orbit, but nothing that's leaving the solar system. Okay. Back to Dick.
The two Pioneer spacecraft were launched earlier than Voyager. Therefore, you would think that they had a chance to get further, and they'd be further out of the solar system than Voyager. And I think the answer is no. Voyager took advantage of the fact that there was an extremely desirable arrangement of almost all of the planets of our solar system for that particular period of time. Voyager was able to use the flyby velocity boost of going by Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and not Pluto. As such, Voyager, I think, is moving away from us at this late stage. Ordinarily, as you move away from the sun, you go slower and slower because the sun is pulling back on you. Let me drop. Now, Paul's going to correct me on this, but I think Voyager is currently moving something like close to 40,000 miles an hour, even though it is 12 billion miles away, three times the distance to Pluto. Still moving at 40,000 miles an hour because of all those gravity boosts, all of those velocity boosts it had by going by all those planets. That alignment of planets is something you only get once every 170 years or something like that, and it occurred at that particular period of time, and Voyager took full advantage of it. Pioneer didn't have that advantage. Therefore, I am guessing Pioneer is flying a lot slower, even though it left a lot earlier. It's nowhere near as far as Voyager. Voyager is by far the most distant object that mankind has ever issued. So correct me on all of the above, Paul. WS2N, K2IW, and TechNet. Are they moving at something like 40,000 miles an hour?
I always use that as an example. 40,000 miles an hour. You can go back to all the old tapes on recorded for Line Mark. I probably quoted saying 40,000. But I tend to estimate everything. And it's really 38,000 miles an hour. And they just confirmed that on an interview. Ed Stone told Anderson Cooper that. So that's true, 38,000. The boost was primarily for a couple of reasons. They used a bigger rocket to take off. That helped in the beginning. Than Pioneer did. Even so, Voyager was a little heavier. It had a lot more thrust. And the primary reason was you get to Jupiter and you pick up like 8,000 miles an hour. You know, and then you get to Saturn and you do the same thing, probably not as fast, but you know, probably 4,000 miles an hour or something like that. So you're gaining speed. The one that's furthest away is Voyager 1. Now that one did not go to Uranus or Neptune. Voyager 2 did. Voyager 2 went there and got the extra speed from those two planets. But that's kind of like, you know, when it's going, it's like going, if you look at an old LP, it's following a curve, a much more extreme curve, like it was almost going around that circumference of the LP, where Voyager 1 got to Saturn, and he really wanted to see what Titan looked like. Let me drop it. And they wanted to see below the clouds. It was extremely cloudy. And couldn't penetrate those clouds and find out what was underneath. So they knew it was a nitrogen atmosphere, but that's about all. So they sacrificed Voyager 1 to go close to Titan. To go close to Titan, they needed to change its trajectory, and they went. They also went to the south of that planet. By going to the south of the planet, when they went south of the moon, they wound up changing the angle. So Voyager 2 is going along the ecliptic. Voyager 1 has changed the angle, and it's going north, like 30 degrees north of the ecliptic, because it went south of the moon Titan. It really didn't work out. Didn't see that much anyway. And then that's more of a direct line going straight out away from the sun than the other one. So that's why Voyager 1 has actually gone further away from the sun, even so they're both going around 38,000 miles an hour. New Horizons is not going to do that. New Horizon will probably around 10-20 years from now will probably be going about 8,000 miles an hour less than Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, unfortunately, but that's the way it goes, because that did not have the gravity assist, like you said earlier, sir, like Voyager 1 and 2 did.
The 60 Minutes presentation on CBS television last Sunday, November 19th, I guess it was, yes. That's available to you. If you go to the CBS website, you'll have to do a little bit of searching around, but you'll eventually get a playback of that exact 60 Minutes program. It is worth seeing. It was extremely well done. They did it last Sunday because it was the 40th anniversary of Voyager. And Carl Sagan was heavily involved with what Voyager did. Two of the most significant things that Voyager did is not only go so far, so long, 40 solid years of operating that nuclear power supply, 40 solid years of that approximately 20-watt output traveling wave tube that's talking back to Earth over the 12 billion miles. At the speed of light, the signal takes 18 and a half hours to get to us. So a round-trip signal. You say hello to Voyager, and Voyager answers you 37 and a half hours later at the speed of light. That's just out of sight. Pun intended. Let me drop it. And it's still talking to us anytime that we want to. It'll tell us what the meteoroid impacts are like, what the solar wind is like. It has left the solar system. It no longer is seeing a significant amount of solar wind. It's now seeing galactic wind instead of solar wind. But at great difficulty, Carl Sagan convinced them to take a picture of Earth. They said, why the hell would you want to do that? Earth at 12 billion miles would just be a fraction of one pixel on the electronic camera on Voyager. Why would you want to do that? Well, they carefully chose a time to take a picture of the Earth from Voyager a couple of years ago. And when you see that picture, it happens to be superimposed on one of the rings of Saturn. It's a little dot of Earth. And so it gives you a little bit of... Let me drop this. Carl Sagan knew you would get a humble feeling out of seeing that when you look back at the solar system, you look at the sun and the earth from that distance, it is so insignificant. Every human being you have ever known, the whole history of mankind and all of our previous ancestry, of all of the evolution that resulted in mankind on this planet, is all represented by a fraction of one pixel on the camera of Voyager when it uses its highest telescope aimed at the Earth. And the longevity of that electronics. That dish has approximately a 1 degree beam width at 8.5 gigahertz. That 1 degree beam width has to be aimed precisely at the Earth and as an L. Otherwise, you're never going to hear that weak signal from that far away. 315 decibels of loss one way is the signal strength loss because of that distance. What does 315 decibels mean? You write 1 with 31 zeros after it. That's the ratio of the signal that Voyager transmits versus the amount of signal that you get. That ratio is 1 with 31 zeros after it. That's a big number. Take my word for it. Let me drop. On top of that, Voyager has this record which says hello in something like 60 languages on planet Earth. They say hello and I think it was Carl Sagan's son that says one of those messages. And it's also got the playback on the record has pictures of animals and scenes and whatever on Earth. The chances of a alien civilization finding that record, playing it back, and knowing what Earth is like, the chances of that happening is very slim. You could say that it was more for the benefit of mankind that that record was made. And I think that was part of the philosophy that Carl Sagan had when he did that. But that Voyager is one hell of a mission to aim to the nearest fraction of a degree at planet Earth for 40 solid years so that you could talk to that thing. If that dish goes, let me pick a number, 5 degrees wrong in azimuth elevation, that very sharp pencil beam out of that 12-foot diameter dish running at 8.5 gigahertz, if that signal is aimed just a little bit wrong and it misses Earth, you ain't going to talk to that thing again forever. And they've been talking to it for 40 years, finding out what's the conditions like out there. And if all goes well, they'll talk to it for another 10 years. The genius of that system, let me drop it. The genius of that system is that you can order it on the uplink to transmit the data back down to you slower and slower when it gets further and further away and the signal gets weaker and weaker. Right now, the signal is so weak because the system, the Voyager is so far away that it's transmitting the data at something like 150 bits per second. The phase lock loop receiver on the Goldstone dish, a 240-foot diameter dish with a super low noise parametric amplifier listening to that super weak signal, the receiver is a 150 hertz noise equivalent bandwidth when it's listening to that signal. And as Voyager gets further and further away, it eventually will be told, don't send the signal to me at 150, send it at 100, and eventually send it at 50 bits per second. They will narrow up the receiver to be a 50 hertz bandwidth receiver at 8 gigahertz in order to make sure the signal is above the noise so that you can read that signal and get the data. One hell of a system. What a design. I wonder if you're as impressed with that as I am, Kay. LP. AC2PAALP. Change your IW. Go ahead, Kay. Good question.
It's AC2LR. Think of always continue love radio, if that helps. As I was listening to you, I was thinking of a report I heard that the linguistics department at Cornell was the main people who put the different language greetings and on the record, and they were allowed to say whatever they wanted. And one guy in like a local language from China said, "Hello, star friends. Have you eaten today? Come visit us if you can." Which I thought was an interesting stream of thought. Hopefully they don't eat Earthlings. But the other thing I just read recently was that in about 200 years, a Voyager is just going to be entering the Oort cloud, and it will take about 30,000 years to exit the Oort cloud. So it has to, it'll be dead by then, right? AC2LR, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, forgive me, Kay. I couldn't read my own writing. It looked like AC2LP. The R looked like a P. That's why I made that goof. You and I haven't talked often enough, and I'm very forgetful. I think they're anticipating the nuclear power supply and the traveling wave tube is probably, with a little bit of luck, is good for another 10 years. Rough number. So, and what is the solar wind, what is the galactic wind like? And what are the meteoroid impacts like? Almost every of the... I'm guessing there's 10 or 12 different experiments on board, and all of them have been turned off except the transmitter that tells you how many meteoroid impact it's getting and what is the solar wind like. I think that's the only thing that's left running. They're not even using the camera anymore because there's nothing to take a picture of. When you're that far away from our solar system, there's nothing significant to take a picture. A picture of Earth is a fraction of one pixel on that camera. And for all we know, it's a megapixel mosaic in that camera. Let me drop it. And so it's whether or not mankind in the next century is going to send a spacecraft with that kind of longevity at that great a distance is unlikely because of that alignment of planets that allowed them to get out there. And by the way, Paul thinks he's made a big error where we're estimating at 40,000 miles an hour and it's only moving at 38,000 miles an hour. At that distance, that's a big number. If you and I wanted to not use gravity assist of flying by a whole bunch of planets, if we wanted to build a rocket that on its pure rocket power got out to that distance and is moving at 38,000 miles an hour, I don't think a 5 could do that. You get a huge energy increase every time you fly by one of the planets, and it takes a favorable alignment, which doesn't occur very often, to do that. So that was one hell of an opportunity. So we're not going to top that record for a long time to come. And Carl Sagan doing a lot of good work on that one. Anybody any further questions or further comments on Kay's question, give me a call. That is right now, K2IW in the TechNet. We're about to go over to Roy. You've got it for anybody with anything further on Kay's question.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
I recommend the book The Pale Blue Dot by Carl Sagan. And in that book, I mean, it's a very good book. Naturally, The Pale Blue Dot is heard. But in that book, they show you the picture. When it was taken, it was Valentine's Day, I believe in 1990. So he talked him into doing that. And on the interview with their... 60 minutes, they did say that...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Canceled.
So that little half a pixel is probably down to probably 1/16th of a pixel or something. Back to you, sir.
Having trouble getting my transmitter to come back on. But for those people who are willing to take the time to go to CBS television and find the 60 minutes program of... November 19th, 2017. And I think that was the second presentation. Let me drop.
That's right, Dick.
Yeah, I think it was the second presentation of the three presentations that night. And you can select which one you want to listen to and play it back. It is worth going to. The book from Carl Sagan is worth going to. There was another thing I was going to recommend that people go to. Well, NASA has a whole lot of information about Voyager. I was guessing that the hello was in 60 separate Earth languages. Is that roughly true, if you remember, Eric? I mean, Paul, how many languages was that record in, and how many pictures were on that record? And we think we're doing that for telling the aliens what we're like. The chances of that being picked up is pretty slim. We're really doing it to think more galactically. It was more a benefit for mankind than for the aliens. Over to you for any comments on all of the above, Paul. WS2N, K2IW.
I forgot how many pictures are. I think they said 80 pictures. At least 60 languages. They have Johnny B. Good. They made a point of that on the 60-minute show with Chuck Berry. But Anne Duran, she eventually married Carl Sagan. But they worked on that together. And she's still around. He's not. She approved the second Cosmos show that Tyson did a couple years ago. So she worked with them on that. So anything to do with Carl Sagan is good. I got a whole bunch of his books. So, yeah, I definitely recommend the Pale Blue Dot. Might as well go over to Roy if nobody else has anything for now. We'll do the space net later, I guess. Time's ticking away. Wow. Back to you, Dick.
Hey, dude, John. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, if you're interested in listening to what's on the actual gold record, you can stream it on Amazon. Let's see. I think, yeah, they were actually selling the record a number of years ago, but I don't think they're still doing that. But you can get to listen to what's on it.
You're right. I think there's a YouTube video that will tell you an awful lot of what's on that record. They will let you listen to all of those languages, or you can go to a spreadsheet where you can decide which language you want to hear hello in. And one of the nice sounding ones was Carl Sagan's son. I think he said hello from planet Earth or something along those lines. That was a real good mission. Sorry to keep you waiting so long, Roy, because the subway system, we had an unusual group of people that were telling us how the subway really works, the electronics in the subway. I don't know about you, but I've been very curious about that. So when it it comes to the science physics section, which we've delayed too long tonight.
Did Paul have a TV question?
Did Paul have a TV? Yes. Paul, go right ahead with your TV question.
I did, but I was getting late, so I wasn't going to do it this week. But, I want to find out if they have HDR. HDR is high dynamic range for the TVs. I know that's the big thing now. If you go to a store now and buy one, that they'll tell you that that's one of the things that they have. You know, there might be a 4K machine, but they'll say it's got HDR or it's got a WCG, wide color gamut. Wonder if they're going to have that, maybe they do now, on broadcast, you know, TV. If you go to hook it up on your cable system, they say they don't really have it on that, but they'll have it on Netflix, and some of the streaming content will have it. I'm wondering if it's going to be, I would imagine someday in the future they'll have it, or if maybe they'll actually have it now, because it makes a big difference in picture quality. Back to you, Eric.
All right, Paul, you're talking about two different things. Wide color gamut and high dynamic range. You know, high dynamic range came first, but as part of the same system, you wind up with both, actually. As far as over-the-air broadcast, when the new broadcast system begins, all the stuff that's actually being produced now is actually being recorded 12-bit, which is HDR. The newer cameras are doing the wide gamut. So the stuff that's being archived at this point, before the broadcasters actually get their hands on it, because they will have a way to transmit it, as soon as they come on, they will probably come on with the source material that some of it doesn't have high dynamic range and some of it does. So the broadcast system itself is capable of handling that. It's all in the compression scheme. So, yes, the monitor that you're buying now that's 4K that says it's high dynamic range and wide color gamut, well, some of them might not be wide color gamut, but when you get your converter box for your 4K set and they start broadcasting, you're going to see some of that.
That's very good news. Okay. I suspected that you would, but I wasn't sure. That's very good news. Back to you, Dick.
The only thing I would say that I don't know is the existing 4K sources at the moment on Fios and the other services may not actually be capable of doing the 12-bits. So you might not get them there for a while.
Understood. Yeah, that's pretty much what I was reading. But what I couldn't find out, I couldn't find out anything about broadcast. But now I know.
On a slightly different subject of television, Eric, if I look at every single over-the-air broadcast station that's available to me as of a couple of days ago, the frame rate, I'm going to call it frame rate, scan rate, seems to be only in three formats, 480i, 1080i, or 720p. I never see anything but those three. Is some of that limitation because of my particular set that might really be some others? Is question number one. And question number two, how come the 480 and the 1080 are always interlaced, I, and the 720 is always progressive, not interlaced? What's magic about the lowest and the highest being interlaced and the middle being progressive? KE2EJ, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Your set is actually capable of doing 36 different flavors, or 32 different flavors of resolution. Why, 480i. Now, let's talk about legacy. What are the actual numbers that you get when you take a normal analog ATSC signal? What's its number of lines and frame rate?
In the United States, 525 lines. In Europe, I think it's in
line British. Britain, I think, at 625. But I think we run a 525 line analog system in the old days. Was my memory. Go ahead. I may have it backwards.
Yeah, it's 525 lines. It's 525 lines. Only 480 of them are active. I actually have picture information. That's the first thing. What's the frame rate, Dick?
59.99 frames per second, and it is interlaced. So I can see now why 480i would be very popular, because it requires essentially no conversion. Go ahead.
Okay. Actually, the frame rate is not 60 frames a second. It's 30 frames a second. One frame consists of two interlaced pictures. The first picture being the odd lines, 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, etc. The second picture being 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, etc. Why?
Okay, I said 59.99. I was talking about fields, not frames. I used the wrong word. But those numbers are very close to the 60 hertz, so therefore the bar doesn't crawl across the screen in a noticeable manner. And in the early days of monochrome, it literally was exactly 30 frames per second, 60 fields per second. It became 59.99, or some number like that, because of the...
59.94, if you want to be precise.
Because of the irrationality of the 3.579545 chrominance subcarrier frequency that was chosen, and the herringbone that that generates. You wanted that herringbone to be as low in resolution on the screen as possible so that it doesn't become an artifact. Over to you, is my guess on that. Over to you, Eric, KQIW.
Well, in the case of running at 60, it actually creates what we call chroma crawl. It's around the edges of items, you'll see little dots that are moving, as opposed to more a kind of a thing, or a herringbone, as you call it. Actually, that number, the actual horizontal rate at standard NTSC is not a perfectly even division, but I'm getting away from where I wanted to go. The point is that it's 30 frames a second. If I were to transmit it at 60 frames a second, I would need twice the bandwidth in order to be able to do that. I had to keep the stuff within 4.5 megahertz, if you remember correctly, right?
So far, so good. It makes sense. Now we have a lot of explanation for where the 1080 interface, interlaced 1080i came from. Correction, the 480i. Where did the 1080i come from, Paul? That's not an even multiple of 480. Go ahead.
Okay, when high definition first came around, it was still analog. Okay, and to make things work and to do things easily so that you could go from one format to the other, what we essentially did was double the number of lines. We kept the interlace and we kept the frame rate. So it's still 30 frames a second, or actually 29.945 something. And we can make this translation in the analog world from 480 to 1080. It's not exactly. Actually, the first standard was 1035, believe it or not. I actually have an old analog HD recorder that records 1035. So by using delay lines and some smart additive stuff, which still kind of like was. We had barely gone from tubes to solid state at that point. That was the easy transition. The other reason for it being there, I'm going to drop. When it came to the transmission standard, there were a number of ways to do it. There were quite a few different methods. Actually, one of the coolest methods was developed by Dr. Bill Glenn. He was in CBS Laboratories at the time. He was part of the Peter Goldmark group that invented a whole lot of stuff, including the old long playing record. He had a class down in Florida. His wife had a psychology graduate class, and they were doing physiological psychology. And what they did was they did a study on what the eyeball sees. So they were able to break it down into math, what it is that we see and what it is that we don't see, and what we need to know temporally, what we need to know spatially. And from that, he came up with a system that was compatible to our current system. I'm going to drop again. His system allowed you to transmit the conventional analog NTSC on an analog low VHF channel or a high VHF channel, and he would transmit 3 megahertz worth of information that you need to take that picture and turn it into the high definition picture. There are a bunch of different schemes, but as digital came on and we moved into the MPEG world, things started to change. So the progressive picture, or the P picture, is now you're actually seeing, your eyeball is seeing twice the frame rate. So by using MPEG compression, I can easily put 1240 by 780 on my broadcast signal and transmit them with enough bits so that it makes a very good quality picture. And let me drop again. Psychologically, it was actually a physiological psychology class, a graduate class. That's who did the research. That research was used by a lot of people. Actually, Bill Glenn was the first one to come up with the digital noise reducer that worked in video. It was actually made by CBS Labs. Psychologically, or physiologically, a lot of people like the 720p picture in terms of looking at it for sports and motion. The progressive picture being each frame being the whole picture, as opposed to the interlace with stuff that's fast moving, where the odd lines and the even lines might be slightly displaced because of the temporal motion that's going on in the picture. So there's actually more flavors now that we're talking 4K, which is, it's actually not 4025 like we would have in a digital world or computer world, but it's actually reduced to 30, I forget the number. It's 3,000 something lines, for the reason being that it's easier to do the compression.
I thank you, Eric. Now I understand a lot more of what's going on. So the 720p is really giving you twice the frame rate, or almost twice the frame rate. So in certain kinds of fast motion,
twice the frame rate, not almost.
How about that?
Sure.
Now I know. Good stuff. Roy, we've kept you waiting an awful long time. I'm sorry, but we've had this unusual group of people tonight telling us about the subway. So tell us anything you'd like to on the subject of science, physics, and your favorite subjects. Because for people who really like what you present, AC2GS, K2LIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Hello, Dick. Hello, Paul. Hello, Eric. Hello, the rest of you. I started to sense that I was forgotten, but I realized I wasn't. I did keep busy. Someone on Echolink from the metropolitan area is visiting the Philippines, so I conversed with him, and some people in Canada wanted to listen to the stream on W2LIE.net. And their stream is down, so I put up a new stream for those guys. So there's a couple people in Canada listening to my stream. So I've been keeping busy. But let's go to regular housekeeping. Also, Steve KD2HUC wanted me to let you know that he can hear you, but he can't transmit right now. So that's why he didn't respond to your inquiry. Let it drop for a sec.
Yeah, I'm going to interrupt you for a second, Roy. I know that you and... Let me drop... you and Andy, about an hour before the TechNet, were doing an experiment back and forth about adjusting your audio to try to make it sound more like communication quality. And because of the equipment that Andy was using, maybe from his automobile, he's talked you into adjusting your voice in a way that sounds a bit unnatural. It may have very good communication quality, but it's not... not quite as pleasant to listen to. If you had the ability to go back to the way your audio used to be, in my opinion, it would be a slight improvement. If it's too much trouble, don't worry about it. AC2GS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is exactly the way I had it before I played equalization games with it. Does it sound better this way?
Believe it or not, it sounds more natural, but it is muffled. I'm guessing that Andy's original complaint was the high-frequency notes are lacking. It's a little bit muffled, but even though with that muffled sound, it's a little bit more natural. It sounds like the way that I think you sound compared to what you previously did. If you could go halfway between the two, it would be fantastic. Over to you, Roy. And maybe I'm nitpicking. Don't let this trouble you. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Feel free to nitpick. Okay, this is some kind of a compromise between the two settings. How's this?
It's quite good. Anything you could do to increase the volume above 1 kilohertz would be helpful. Right now, your audio is very good up to 1 kilohertz, and it starts rolling off fairly fast after that is a rough guess on my part. I'm wearing earphones.
Okay, what about this? Does this sound any better?
Fantastic. Whatever you did, great improvement. Can you do just a tiny bit more of it?
Okay, this is a tiny bit more. How's this?
You have arrived. Please proceed. Great improvement. Go ahead, Dr. Roy.
Okay, very good. I just want to do a little housekeeping. The mailbag address, because people don't seem to be sending me anything in the mailbag. The mailbag address is mailbag@limarktech.net. Again, mailbag@limarktech.net. So please send me email, even if you don't have a question. Just say hello. I'm feeling lonely as far as that email address is concerned. In last week's episode, I have a bunch of little stories, but I don't know if I have time for any of the bunch of little stories. Like, there's a story about a guy in California, a 61-year-old limousine driver, who has built his own rocket ship, and he planned on strapping himself in it and flying about 1,800 feet into the air yesterday. I wonder if anyone heard about that guy.
Yeah, I, for one, would like to hear these stories, Roy. And don't worry about do we have the time. We'll make the time. 1,800 feet in the air with a rocket. My first question is, does he think he's going to survive? Does he have a backup system to ensure his survival? Does he have FAA approval for that launch? Over to you, Roy.
Well, probably the best answer is no to everything. It number one, it's a steam-powered rocket, which I am unfamiliar with the concept of a steam-powered rocket. He kind of built it. He told people that it cost him about $20,000-$25,000. He built it. He put it up in some little Mojave Desert town called Amboy, California. And it was his first effort. If it succeeded and he didn't kill himself, he was intending to build bigger and bigger rockets, and the game plan apparently was that he was going to fly up, I think it was 80 miles above the Earth, and take studies because he's a member of the Flat Earth Society, apparently, and he wants to prove that the Earth is flat.
Wow. Now, when it comes to a steam-powered rocket, that's a very efficient, very simplistic rocket system. The first time we heard about that was Evel Knievel. Evel Knievel was going to jump over this great big canyon with a steam-powered rocket. To build a real rocket engine with the turbo pumps and the cooling system and everything else is extremely elaborate. To build your own rocket engine, it's going to take you 10 years to perfect it, to just keep the thing alive for more than 30 seconds, if you know what I mean. A steam-powered rocket is a very crafty device that Evel Knievel used. So he's on the right track on that one. But still, what kind of backup system, what kind of recovery system? Does he have FAA approval? Has he tried it with dummies? 4 times in a row and been successful before he puts a human being on board. There's a